some passages that don't get preached a lot because they're uncomfortable. And to be quite honest with you, they're sort of PG-13. And so I'm going to delve into this in about a minute and a half. So if you want to go volunteer for the nursery, they always need helpers. But it's sort of going to be a PG-13 sermon this morning. Last week we began and we looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1 through 7, where Paul is teaching about marriage and singleness, and he says, first of all, it's okay to be single because Jesus was single, but it's okay to be married too because God invented marriage. But the thing is that if you get married, understand marriage runs on duty, not desire. You have a duty of kindness, you have a duty of priority to your mate. And if you think about it, in some sense, doesn't duty become more desirable anyway? I mean, I was talking to a guy in his 50s, and we were fishing together, and I know him to be a guy who spent his 20s and 30s chasing every pretty face that he could find in town. But he looked at me and said, you know what I find attractive in a woman now? And I'm thinking, well, this has something to do with physical appearance, knowing him. And he said, a good mother. That's so attractive these days. And what's he saying? He's saying desire. I mean, duty is desirable. I mean, if you're a woman, right, don't you reach some point in your life where more desirous than a six-pack is a guy, abs, not six, other, six-pack. Is it a guy who can hold a job sort of more desirous than a guy who's built in a certain physical way? I mean, to some degree, duty does become more desirable. And so that's what Paul said. Single is great, marriage is great, but marriage runs on duty, not desire. Now, he goes on in verse 8 through 11, and he talks to three classes of people. He talks to those who are single, those who are married, those who are separated. And there's a constant theme, I think, to each. He is talking to them about being in control of your passions. In whatever state you're in, be in control of your passions. Verse 8 through 11 says this: "But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them if they remain even as I am, but if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Now to the married I command, yet not I but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. But even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, and a husband is not to divorce his wife." Amen. It's going to be a fun Sunday, isn't it? He says, you got to control your passions. And to the singles he says, listen, if you're single and you burn with passion, then you need to address the burning with passion. You need to get married. This is what Paul is saying. Now, when you talk about burning with passion, he's not talking about regular passion. I think there's a healthy passion. And if you think about it, you've got a fireplace in your house. It's controlled. It's there. It's a fire. But it's under control. But then there's a fire that can burn down your house. And he's saying, I'm not talking about something that's healthy. I'm talking to singles. I'm not saying if you have a healthy passion that you should get married. But I am saying that if you are controlled, if you are a house on fire, you need to do something about that passion. And I am recommending that you find someone to marry. Because nothing will put passion out like marriage. That's right. That's right. So you need to get married to deal with the passion in your life. Now, here's another place in Scripture that we have the prohibition to sexual activity outside of marriage. And I want to take some time this morning to talk to you about why that comes up again and again and again in the Scriptures. Because it does come up often. Marriage is restricted to the fireplace, or sex is restricted to the fireplace, and the fireplace is marriage, one man, one woman for life. And I think oftentimes people hear that and they think, boy, Christians are so fuddy-duddy on, on well, you know, but there's a fuddy-duddy about that. But you have to understand, first of all, the Christian ethic is also the Judaic ethic, and it's also the Islamic ethic. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all restrict sexual activity to marriage. And what other thing do you know that the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims all agree upon? But they can't agree upon that, at least. Now, again, sometimes people hear that and they say, boy, the Christians just, you know, sort of the doctrine that Christians espouse is sex is forbidden, it's dirty, it's bad, so save it for your husband. Save it for your wife. That's sort of what I think gets heard, but actually that's not the Christian ethic. Here's why Christianity is restrictive on sexual behavior. It's because Christianity recognizes its innate power. We recognize its innate power. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, it says, the husband shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. There's a double meaning there. The one flesh, the one flesh has a sexual component, but it also has an emotional and spiritual component. In other words, what the Bible would say is that you become one flesh emotionally and spiritually through becoming one flesh physically. It has the power to bind. Look at what Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 16. He says, do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot or a prostitute is one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh. That's the connotation. If you're joined in body with her, you become one flesh with her. It's the joining of the body that accelerates, or more than any other thing, produces one flesh, which is oneness physically, emotionally, and spiritually. It's oneness at the core. That's why the physical was given, to make the spiritual and emotional more a possibility. See, it's just not about childbearing. That's secondary. And oftentimes in Christianity, people say, well, yeah, sexuality was given to produce children. That's secondary. What it is primarily given to is that the physical is given to promote the spiritual and emotional binding. So he says, why would you ever go to a prostitute? Why would you ever want to be emotionally and spiritually bound in that way to a person that you're not married to, that is with lots of other people? Why would you ever do that? See, there is power to bind or to bond through sexuality. And that's why, if maybe even in high school, maybe in marriage, but the first time you had sexual relations with a person, you felt more jealous of them. Wasn't an issue for them to be seen talking to another person as much before that, but after you bond physically, there's an emotional and spiritual bonding that happened. Now there's a sort of a jealousy that begins to happen. You feel bonded to them in a way that you would have never felt before the physical. The physical produces the emotional and the spiritual. That's why it was given. Wendy Shallot wrote a book called Return to Modesty. It's sort of dated. I think it's a 1999 copyright. So it's a bit dated, but Wendy Shallot wasn't a Christian. She was a young lady. I believe she was Jewish, but it's a great book. And so Christmas is coming up. Buy your teenager Return to Modesty, and I hope that they take it to heart. But she writes in that book, she said, she had a friend who was in her 30s. When she was in her early 20s in college, she had an affair with a professor for a brief period of time. And it didn't last maybe two or three months. He moved on to somebody else. That was his pattern. And so she was, I guess, for better use of the word, dumped in that situation. But she said it's interesting that she's talking to her friend more than 10 years after that fleeting relationship. And her friend, the tone that she talks about that relationship. Now, she's moved on. She's married. She's got kids. But the way she talked about that relationship, she said, it sounded like a woman would talk about an ex-husband. It sounded not like a breakup, but like a divorce. And she says, again, that's the power of the bonding that happens. The physical produces the emotional and the spiritual. And that's why you might be on Facebook, and it's been 20 years, but you had that relationship a long time ago, and you find yourself wondering what that person's doing. Like, I wonder if they had any kids. I sort of wonder where they're at. Yeah, you're not telling anybody that, but you're searching their name. You're Googling their name. Why? Because the physical produced an emotional and spiritual bond. That's what it was designed to do. That's what God created it to do. It's interesting when you go back and read books from like the 1940s and 50s on marriage. It's completely different than what you would read today. In the 1940s and 50s, and I got some of those books, it was all about role orientation. And so if you want to have a successful marriage and if you want to have a good, happy, healthy marriage, the wife stays in the kitchen, she stays home, she takes care of the kids, she does wifey things, and the man goes out and he works and he takes care of the lawn, he does husband things. And it's role distinction that creates a happy marriage in those books. But you read a book today after the sexual revolution, and what do they tell you you need to have a happy marriage? You need to do everything in common. You need to hike together and to play tennis together. You need to cook together. And you need to find couples that you spend time. And everything's together. Whereas you go back to the 40s and 50s, everything is separate. She has her roles. He has his roles. But now today, it's like, no, you got to have common interests. You got to do common. Got to get together. And it's just interesting that before the sexual revolution, when people were usually saving sex for marriage, they could end up in a marriage, and how did they feel close together? How were they bonded? Not through common activity. They slept together. That's how they got bonded. But now today, after the sexual revolution, and most people are married and they've had relationships previous to that marriage, now they get into a relationship, and now it's like, we got to find something in common. And it's almost as though they're trying to create glue. They're trying to bond each other through common activities, common interest. Whereas before, when the people were saving themselves for a marriage, sleeping together did all of that. And he could do his thing, she could do her thing, but they were very tightly bonded in the end anyway. It bonds you. Bonds you. Paul said, why would you do that? You'd be bonded to her emotionally and spiritually if you bonded with her physically. And so when you use what God has given in this way outside of marriage, only two things could happen. One is that it works and it bonds you and you end up in a marriage, but to some degree, you have emotional and spiritual bonds with other people that you had previous relationships with, which then affects that current relationship. It works. Or you break it and it stops to work and no longer has any bonding power in your life. This is an awful illustration, but you remember as a kid, if you did something good in school, they'd give you like this sticker with like a first place thing on or something, and you put it on and you're really proud of the sticker and so you wanted to wear it all week, but by the time you put on five different shirts, it wouldn't stick to anything anymore. Yeah, there's a sense in which if you use sex outside of marriage, it stops being sticky anymore. And so now you're in a relationship potentially where it's like, we got to do everything together because the very thing that would bond us emotionally and spiritually has been broken. It doesn't function in that way anymore for us. And so you lose the very thing that would make you feel so married. You have to sort of use other substitutes for that. I remember Tim Keller talking once. Awfully quiet here. You can excel, by the way. You can breathe. don't have to hold your breath for that long. I remember Tim Keller talking, and he had a friend who was a pastor who was counseling a husband and wife, and at the center of the problem was that she had insane jealousy. I mean, he couldn't do anything. He was getting 3, 4, 5 phone calls a day. Where are you at? What are you doing? That kind of thing. There was just this insane jealousy that was really destroying the relationship. And he couldn't figure out why, because the husband seemed like a good guy, faithful. He would counsel them together and then separately. And it's like he just didn't see any basis for her jealousy. As he talked to the husband, it's like, oh, why is she this way with him? And then he slept on one of their conversations, and he thought, oh, I understand now. Next time he met with the wife, he said, so, are you still having the affair, or did it end? And she was a deer in the headlights, and she said, it's over. How did you know? He said, just understand that he's bonded to you. And every time you two sleep in the same bed together, that's his way of bonding you. He is close to you, but you aren't close to him because you have taken the thing that would make you close and you have used it outside of marriage. So now you no longer feel bonded to him. You no longer feel close to him. He feels close to you, but you don't feel close to him. You're not connected to him emotionally and spiritually as you would like because you broke the thing that would connect you emotionally and spiritually. And that's the root of your jealousy. That's what's producing it. And that became the foundation of them fixing that issue in their life. It can only do two things. It was given to bond. And it can bond you, but if you use it outside of marriage, just understand if you get married, you're going to feel bonded in some ways to people outside the marriage, emotionally and spiritually, or you break it and so it loses its power to bond you when you do get married, and that produces a whole other set of issues in your life. That's why, look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18. Paul says, flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body. In other words, it's against somebody else. But he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. He's saying that sexual immorality is the boomerang sin. It comes back and it gets you more than it gets anybody else. Every other sin could be against other people. You aren't that affected. But that's the one sin that when you do it, you sin against yourself. It's going to cost you more than it's going to cost anybody else that you are in a relationship with. See, look at it like this. I drive a car. And it's a four-cylinder. And it doesn't have cruise control. And it's got crank-up windows. If you come up to me on the passenger side, you're going to have to come around or I'm going to have to lean over. I'm going to crank. So just come on around because don't make me lean all the way over and crank that window. It doesn't have much going for it. And I would like to say that I drive it because it's a classic, but it's a Corolla. But the thing about this Corolla is that it's not made for the racetrack. I took a trip to Kentucky. It's not made for the curves in Kentucky. I mean, it's like the little engine that you hope can, but you're not sure that it can or not anymore. And I drive it because I'm cheap. It's not made for the racetrack. There's a lot of things it's not made for. And what the Bible, I think, would tell you is this, that your heart is not made for sexual relationships outside of a lifetime commitment. You're going to foul the thing up from its original intent. In fact, and I need to move on here. In fact, sexual activity outside of marriage devalues you. It hurts your self-esteem. It just does. You are not made to be in relationships where you give everything of yourself to somebody else and have them throw you away or walk away from you or end it. You are not made for those kinds of relationships. Your heart can't take it. And when that happens, it hurts your self-esteem. It drives your self-esteem lower. When you give of yourself in that way and people say, well, that was very nice, but I don't want you. I don't like you. I like that, but I don't want you. It can't but drive your self-esteem lower and make you feel less about yourself. And that's why on all the studies that you see, particularly among teenagers who are sexually active, the rates of depression, the rates of attempted suicide are out the roof, 2, 3, 4 times higher for those who are sexually active as opposed to those who are not sexually active. It drives your self-esteem down. But in the context of a committed relationship, it will drive your self-esteem up. Because when a guy looks at you and says, listen, I want to be with you. I want you in my life so much that I'll stand up at the front of the altar in a tuxedo and I'll tell everybody that I want you. And for the next 50 years of my life, I will do whatever it takes to have you in my life. You know what that does to your self-esteem? It drives it up through the roof. Outside of the lifetime committed relationship, it drives it into the ground. And that has its own set of problems. Your heart is not made for sexual activity outside of a marriage. It will foul you up. I saw a statistic, and this is the government statistic, right? From the Center of Disease Control. For first marriages right now, for first marriages, the divorce rate in the first 5 years is 20%. First marriages, 1 out of 5 will end in the first 5 years. Unless they live together, in which case it's 49%. You are 250 times more likely to get divorced in the first 5 years if sexual activity was done outside of the confines of that marriage. It fouls up the marriage. Now, it doesn't mean that God can't heal. I want you to walk out of here and say it's hopeless. It's not. If God can do anything, He can change hearts. If God can do anything, He can take old things and He can make them new. Behold, all things are new for those who are in Christ Jesus. God, if He can do anything, it's that He can change hearts. He can restore what is lost. He can take back what the devil has stolen or what you surrender to the devil. He can do all that. So don't go out of here feeling hopeless. I just want you to go out here knowing how to pray. You need God to help you to restore your heart to where it was before you abused the gift He gave you, which was given to produce emotional and spiritual intimacy between two people in a lifelong relationship. So Paul says, listen, if you got a problem in that area, you need to fix it. You need to go get married. Now, you hear that and you think, boy, that sounds like a single guy talking. Yeah, what am I supposed to do? Just go down and to the old husband tree and get me a husband? Is that what you're saying? I mean, I'd like to be married, Paul. That's right. I would like to be in that relationship. I realize I got some issues maybe in this area. I would like to be married. But what am I supposed to do? There's nobody standing in line. Well, I think secondly, though, Paul would say, well, you need to get married or you need to learn to control your passions. And actually, it would be better to just begin to learn how to control your passions and ask God to help you than to get into a bad marriage. I think the marriage is, you know, if it's there, it might be nice. I think it's Paul. I don't want to take from what Paul's saying here. But I think regardless, you're going to have to learn how to control your passions anyway. You really are. Because even if you get married, you're still going to have the passion. So you're going to have to work on that anyway. I remember talking to a guy, he was in his 80s, and he had pastored a long time. His name was Joe Smith, and Joe was a great guy and was sort of a mentor to me early on growing up. And holy man, righteous man, wonderful guy. And I was sitting there in his living room talking to him once, and I was ranting about the situation. I'd done some counseling, and I said, Joe, I don't get these young guys, because they'll make decisions based on their sexual passion, and they're not going to even have that when they get older. And how stupid are they going to feel that they made all these stupid decisions based on a passion that they don't even have anymore? And Joe is a very holy man. He cut me off. He said, no, hold on, Pastor. He said, you don't lose the passion. You just lose the ability to do anything about the passion. That's what goes on. And so you always are going to have the passion. So you're going to have to learn how to control the passion anyway. How would you do that? The Bible says a couple of things. It says, first of all, look at Romans chapter 13, 14. But put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust. You saw earlier when we read 1 Corinthians 6:16, it said flee sexual immorality. Notice the language. He says, don't make provision to fulfill its lust. Don't make opportunities. Provision is the provider. It's the one that is making the resource available. It's the drug dealer. He's saying, don't be your own drug dealer. Don't make provisions for the flesh. And so what he's saying is, outsmart yourself. He said, it's simple. There's no magic bullet here. But if you find temptation heavier in that place, don't go to that place. If you find temptation is heavier to look at something on the computer when you're by yourself, do your searching in the middle of a room where there's people. If you have temptations around those people, avoid those people. Don't make provisions. Flee the temptation. And that's really simple. I remember when I was single in seminary, and shouldn't tell you this, but I'm already in deep anyway. I can remember how great it was, how easy it was to control any passion I might have during the long dreaded Indiana winter, because everybody was clothed except from here to here. It wasn't a problem. And then I can remember the first day of spring, when it's like everybody found their short shorts, and it's like you come to campus, it's like, oh, it's like winter was so easy. And I can remember a couple times I had work to do, but I went home and I'd watch the Andy Griffith Show in my room for 4 to 6 hours because I couldn't go out there. I had to get accustomed to the temptation of springtime dress. But you just have to outsmart yourself. You have to say, I'm hanging around here today. I gotta go. I gotta be more in control of where I'm at. You're just gonna have to outsmart yourself. You know where the temptation is heavy. You know where you keep tripping. You're not that dumb. You know it's between the hours of 10 and 12 when nobody's awake in the house. So listen. Throw your computer away. Give it to somebody. Keep forgetting it in somebody's room and you can't go in there to wake them up, so you can't get to your computer. Whatever you got to do, cut off the provision. Outsmart yourself. He said, you need to flee sexual temptation. But there's another thing that I think Jesus says, and it's a bigger principle. It's in Matthew chapter 12. It won't be on the screen. Let me tell you. And there's a lot here to mind, but let me just get at the principle. He says, if a demon is cast out of a man, but the house stays empty, the demon will return with 7 other demons, and the last part will be worse than the first part. Now, there's a principle there, but what he's saying is that the way that you've got to deal with one demon is you've got to put something else in there. That's what Thomas Chalmers would call the expulsive power of a new affection. He says you always have to have an affection, so you got to put something in the place of what you're trying to overcome. I mean, listen, you cannot deal with sexual temptation by saying, I will not think about sex, I will not think about sex, I will not. You cannot deal with it that way. You're going to have to set your mind on something else. And I think that's Jesus Christ. He's a great one to put in the center of your life, to meditate on, to think about on, to think about how you could please Him, to think about all the great things He's done in your life. He's a great one to meditate on. So instead of saying, I can't think about that, I can't think about that, I can't think about that, you need to think about Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. You need to change what you're thinking about. He says, flee, outsmart yourself. It's not rocket science. It's happening at a certain time. It's happening in a certain place. It's happening around a certain group of people. Fix the location problem in your life and start thinking about something other than that. You're not going to overpower that, but through the expulsive power of a new affection, set your mind on something that's greater, more lofty than that, which is Jesus Christ. So he says, you need to deal with that passion in your life. Then, and I'll move very quickly here. Then he says to the married people, he said, if you're married, stay in the marriage. Don't allow passions to drive you out of the marriage. But verse 10, now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. When you get married, there are passions that will drive you out of the marriage. I mean, you're still struggling. It's not always the same passions that you would deal with when you're single. Sometimes it's passions for accomplishment. Sometimes it's passions for freedom. Sometimes it's passions for excitement in your life. And those things left unchecked are very destructive as well. There's an old movie called Dad with Ted Danson in it and a young Ethan Hawke. And Ted Danson had left his family many years before and was back trying to reconnect with his son, Ethan Hawke. And his son asked him why he'd left. And he tries to give him some flighty excuses why he left. But then he just has this moment of honesty. And he says, the problem with the marriage, the reason why the marriage collapsed, was that when I worked and I was successful at my work, it made me feel important. And I liked feeling important. And that's what happened in the marriage. I liked feeling important at the office. So I neglected you and your mother. And that's why the marriage collapsed. See, sometimes you can have a passion to feel important. Sometimes you can have a passion for excitement. Sometimes you can have a passion for freedom. There is such a thing as a midlife crisis, you know. There is. I think I've told you a few years ago, my dad came up to me and he said, I've been watching you, son, and I think you need this book. And it was Men in Midlife Crisis. And he had a midlife crisis. But if you ask mom, if you say, what about dad's midlife crisis? She'll say, which one? There were at least three of them. But there is a sense in which you can get into the middle years of your life. And, you know, you want excitement. You want freedom. It's sort of like you got up to the top of the hill, and as the song says, you look over, the bear went over the mountain, to see what he can see, and all you can see is a downhill slide, and you want to avoid that, and you start trying to run back to your youth. You get a new haircut, you get a new car, maybe you get a new occupation, and maybe sometimes some guys get a new girlfriend, and there is a sense in which that is a flight. It is a passion. It is really you reckoning with the aging process. It's you reckoning that you're not young anymore, that you're long since past, and that you have to accept your mortality. You're going to have to accept what's going on in your life. And by the way, if you're experiencing that, and a large percentage of men experience that, maybe women too, but I know men do, understand that all the experts say your wife can't help you. That's you. You're wrestling with your own mortality. You're wrestling with the fact that you're not as young and as fast or as athletic as you used to be. You're wrestling with the fact that your hair has turned gray or turned loose. You're wrestling with all of those issues. And she can come alongside of you and say, it'll be okay, honey. She can encourage you to go to the gym because if you'll start working out, you'll have a little more energy. You maybe feel a little more youthful. She can help you, but really in those areas, but she can't help you with the core. You've got to fix that yourself. It's not how she looks. It's not how she's changed. It's not her stuff. It's your stuff. Vice versa. But again, you can get in a marriage and you can have those passions. And Paul says you have to control your passions. You're not to allow passions. There's nothing you ought to allow to drive you out of that relationship. You need to get control of that. And then thirdly, very quickly, he says, and to those who have separated, to those who have separated, verse 11, but even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, and a husband is not to divorce his wife. Now, there are some biblical grounds for divorce. Paul doesn't address it there, so I'm not going to address it at this time. But what he's saying is if you do get separated, you need to do everything humanly possible to try to make that relationship work. And your passion is going to be to drive you into another relationship. You're single. I've got the rest of my life to deal with. That relationship feels over to me, and I want to move on with my life. And there is a passion to move forward with your life. But Paul says, don't do that. Stay single. Do everything you can to be reconciled to that mate. Do every possible thing that you can to make that marriage work. Don't go forward. Stay where you are. Work on that so that you can maybe perhaps move forward together, that you can reconcile that marriage. Okay? Now, sometimes, and maybe often, when people have marriage problems, they come to a counselor or a preacher, and they lay it down, and what they want is for the counselor and the preacher to say, it's okay, get a divorce. In I don't want to say most, but in a lot of cases, a high percentage, it's, this is the mess, this is the problem, tell me it's okay to get a divorce. You understand that if a pastor said that, that would be malpractice. Because you're one flesh. Marriage makes you one flesh, which means that divorce is an amputation of the one flesh. You came together as one flesh, and any doctor who would look at you and say, oh, just amputate it. Oh, you got a broken arm? Well, amputate. Oh, you got a bump on your arm? That boy, that's a funny looking rash. Just cut it off. I mean, that would be malpractice. On his behalf, that would be medical malpractice. You have to do everything you can to save the arm, the leg. The last resort, after everything else has failed, might be amputation, but it's not the first resort. And any pastor, any counselor who would make it that easy is malpracticing. It's not your right to recommend amputation for things that might get better on its own. Even with work, even with a splint, even with rehab, even with all those things, if it can be fixed, fix it. I mean, and you know that in your life. Isn't the worst fear you'd have is amputation? I remember when my dad lost his leg. And man, we were so happy that he was knocked out. And they cut it off before he could say anything. Because if he could have kept it, he would have gone through 40, 50 surgeries. I mean, when the doctor came in and the bones was ripped out of the flesh, she said, we're going to try to reattach the foot. But we're not sure that we can. And I remember telling her, if you can't, if there's no chance of being normal, do what you got to do. Because if there was any chance, rest of his life, he would have been trying to make that thing work. You don't want to lose a limb. I got a brother-in-law who fell off a roof, and he fell about 20, 25 feet. He was up there working with a cast on, and it was a metal roof, and he slipped and fell off onto pavement. And he hit on his feet, the cast broke. But right now his heels are about an inch and a half higher than normal heels. It drove it. I mean, his feet are crushed. And when he walks like an old man. And everybody says, amputate your feet. The pain will be gone. You'll have, you know, some stuff. But you'll be in far less pain without your feet than you're going to be the rest of your life with your feet in that shape. But he's going to keep his feet. Doesn't want to cut his feet off. I got a friend who's got a son-in-law in Pennsylvania. He was in an accident in a plant. Somehow knelt on, I don't know how he did this, but he knelt on glass and got hundreds of pieces of glass shard up into his knee. And they were only able to get, I think, about 300 of those pieces of shard out through multiple surgeries. But there's hundreds of glass shards in his knee. And every time he walks, it feels fresh. And but he did that for years. Years. He finally had his leg amputated because he couldn't take the pain and there was no way to fix the pain. And it was either become basically a drug addict, and even that wasn't going to fix the pain or deal with it. And he couldn't, so he cut the leg off. But you'll do anything to keep your limb. Do anything. And that's what Paul is saying. Before you split the flesh, every possible endeavor to fix it has to be exhausted. And then you can amputate. after that, given certain conditions. But he says you need to do that. Again, oftentimes, when you reach that point, you so want to move on, your passions to move forward will push you ahead. Sometimes, you know, people even have the person picked out. You know, remember the old joke? If you know this joke, you're really old. But it's the wife's badgering the husband. You know this one? And she's saying, you know, if I were to die, would you remarry? And he said, where would that come from? Why would you even ask a question like that? And she said, I just want to know, would you remarry? He said, I'd never remarry. What are you kidding? Why would he ask something like that? And she badgers him. He said, okay, well, I might remarry. I might. Possible. She said, well, if you did remarry, would you live in this house? He said, well, maybe that would make sense. Well, you wouldn't use our bedroom, would you? So, well, it's a master bedroom. I guess that would make sense. She said, I can't believe you'd say something like that. She said, and she goes on, and would you do this and would that, you do that? And then she says, you wouldn't let her use my golf clubs, would you? You know that one? And he says, no, she's left-handed. She's left-handed. Yeah. Sometimes you have them picked out. And all you want to do is move on. And the divorce happens. And you just want to get on with your life. That's understandable. But again, I don't get to write the word. I just get to preach the word. And Paul says, you need to do everything you can to fix that relationship. Don't move on. Work to reconcile. To the singles, he says, control your passions. To the married, he says, control your passions. To those who are contemplating divorce, he says, you got to control your passions too. You read a passage like that and you just know you need God's help, right? It's a hard passage to live if God doesn't come in and he doesn't help you. And maybe as you stand, go ahead and stand. And once you stand, I can't talk, but maybe for another 30 seconds before you look at me evil. But maybe you sense a need of God's help in your life. Maybe you do. We talked a lot to the singles, but some of you are married. Some of you are married, and maybe you're at that stage in life where marriage seems dull and you want excitement in your life. Maybe you've got to the mountain and there's something driving you back to your youth, and it would devastate your marriage if you followed those passions, and you need help. You need to surrender those passions to the Lord. Let Him help you with that. Maybe you're contemplating divorce. I don't know where your marriage is at. Like you don't know where mine's at. Maybe it's not where it ought to be. But I just want to admonish you again with the scriptures. Do everything that is humanly possible to make that relationship work. That's not me, that's the Bible. Do everything that's possible to make that relationship work. And God will be with you. He invented marriage. He did it. And what He invents, we can have great confidence that He will help sustain. It's His ideal. He brought it into existence. And you need to go to Him and say, I'm having trouble with managing your invention. As the inventor, help me. He can do that. You know what Jesus said once? Matthew chapter 19, he says, really, the only reason that there would ever be marriage trouble, he said, there's only one reason why there would be marriage trouble. You have to read this, Matthew 19. He says, it's due to hard-heartedness. On one side of the spouse, or on one side, or on both sides. The only reason there would ever be marriage problems is because somebody has allowed their heart to get hard towards the other one. That's the root of it, isn't it? And so maybe you need the Lord to soften your heart today. He can. You probably can. That's going to take a miracle to soften you and to make you sweet and kind towards your mate again. He can do that. The Lord will help you. He will. Do you believe that? Do you believe that He can help you? He can help you today. Humbly ask Him as we sing. You have a need.